This podcast is sponsored by Bombfell. Open and close. Get $25 off your first purchase by visiting bombfell.com/GOT. That's bombfell.com/GOT.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're talking about Season 8, Episode 3 again. Again, we're talking about it. This time it's the spoiler edition. Aaron, what do we have today?
Spoiler, my opinion on the episode is largely unchanged. Like I said on the instant take, it's a lot to think and absorb. And as a book reader and a show watcher, both, and someone who spent a lot of time invested in thinking about the intricate plot that we've got here, it was a lot to think about. And I thought, you know what we should do? We should call our old buddy Kim Renfrow, because she's kind of got similar amounts of investment as us, and she's even, I think, usually got her ear closer to the ground on the production side. And I kind of wanted to see what she thought. So we're going to do that right now. All right. Joining us from Los Angeles here in our humble studio in Cincinnati is Kim Renfrow, who is an entertainment correspondent for Insider. And you probably recognize her voice because she's been on a couple podcasts the last few seasons. Welcome back to the show, Kim.
Thank you so much for having me. Super stoked to be here.
So we set up this because we know we wanted to have you on our show again because it's always fun. And we're talking about like, oh, which episode should we do? And everyone knew that like the third episode is going to be this big battle and there'll be lots of deaths. And we can kind of commiserate on which ones are the most impactful ones and impact the plot. And then we saw this episode and, Jorah's death. How that just blows holes in all kinds of in-game Game of Thrones theories. Ed, how many theories were based around Dolorous Ed? So many.
The 999th Lord Commander.
Yes, yes, yes.
The Night's Watch.
Yeah.
Theon got to me a little bit, but I think I was overly prepared for Theon to die.
Yeah.
Like, I saw that coming miles away. Same
right.
with Jorah. So, like,
yeah.
As great as I think that scene was, yeah, I didn't get, like, the gut punch from most of the other deaths I was prepared for, like Brienne or Podrick, even. How the heck is Podrick Payne?
Right.
Still my
yeah,
sweet pod.
On the front lines, no less. I started thinking, and I'm thinking, up until this episode, I had like kind of like some unshakable ideas about how the end of Game of Thrones would relate to the end of the book series, which is our spoiler cast. So there's like, you know, you could talk about the books and the lore and all that kind of stuff. And I hung my hat on ideas like, okay, Valonqar prophecy, not in the TV show, but everything but the Valonqar part is in the TV show, and they are, you know, the idea that someone who would kill Cersei would be different from the books to the TV show was just completely like mind blowing to me. Like I just didn't count on it. But now after I see that instead of going through any kind of like deeper kind of like book prophecy that would guide who might end the menace of the others, the White Walkers, the Night King, that they went with Arya, which is a valid option, but it certainly doesn't seem like it's the direction from the books. I'm starting to wonder, is this final season just Dan and David riffing on Martin? How many of those bullet points are intact in their eyes? What are your thoughts on that, Kim?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest questions I had going into this season was definitely how the show was going to tie up all of these loose ends and which one of those would track with George's story. I also was like very prepared for how divisive that would be, but like we can get into that in a bit. But yeah, it's interesting because both Benioff and Weiss and then Martin himself have like talked at length about that meeting they had back in, you know, where they met up in Santa Fe, and he told them sort of like the general outlines. But there's so many there's so many weird caveats to that. I actually just was reading a Time magazine interview that Benioff and Weiss did in 2017, where they said, quote, certain things that we learned from George way back in that meeting are going to happen on the show, but certain things won't, end quote. And like, I don't know that I had ever really registered that before necessarily seen that. And it's kind of surprising to me that, yeah, that this major battle of Winterfell that, you know, season 8 hyped up, you know, HBO's entire official trailer was all about this battle, basically. And right. The cast and crew have been talking about it for ages. And then, like, for almost all of that to feel like it was not part of George's plan whatsoever is really surprising. And I think that that's part of why we're seeing such like a sort of like whiplash in the fandom right now. And people just like don't really know how to process.
Yeah.
That.
What did you think of the decision to have the Arya be the night killer, the night ender?
It definitely shocked me. Like, I did not think the Night King was going down in this episode at all, let alone at Arya's hands. But I don't dislike it. It fits. Of all the characters that they had alive and fighting, she's by far one of the most trained and skilled who would have been able to go up toe-to-toe against any of the White Walkers. It's really interesting to me that Benioff and Weiss admitted that they decided that like 3 years ago, which was around when the sixth season was in production. Mm-hmm. I've kind of pinpointed that to something else that they said around season 8, which was when they had Cersei blow up the Sept of Baelor at the season 6 finale. Mm-hmm. They said in the like inside the episode segment after that, they said, Weiss said, at this point in the story, we're trying to play with the pieces we've got on the board. And the wildfire was something that we had on the board. And so I think that they just did the exact same thing with Arya, where they were like, okay, we have to get rid of the Night King and the Army of the Dead somehow. So they like invented this rule that if you kill a White Walker, all the whites that it reanimated fall to. So like that was their solution. So now they just needed one person to get to the White Walker. And then I think that they looked around at all the players and just landed on Arya. And I don't necessarily agree that picking Arya because it's like surprising is the best logic, but she's also not the worst choice that they could have made.
You pointed, because we were doing a little like a kind of pre-show conference, and you mentioned that it's interesting that they went with something that's entirely contained within their show universe, like Melisandre in a show only prophecy uttered the like, you're going to shut brown eyes and green and blue forever. And then, you know, they instead of all the different princess that was promised, Azor Ahai, the last hero, all the different mythologies and prophecies that seems like Martin was setting up to kind of predict who was going to be the last hero, the princess promised, is going to, the end, the long night, the long night part two. They just decided to stay within their universe. Like, hey, you know what? Do you think that was like a safety? Because I like that prophecy was well before season 6. Did you think they created that as like, well, if George gets another book or some more bullet points and it fits, we can always go with that. But hey, we've got the Arya shutting the blue eyes forever in her back pocket, and she's a super trained supernatural assassin. This is our get out of jail free card that we're embedding in our own universe.
No. I think that I can see the case for that argument, but like my gut check there is that like they changed up the Edric Storm storyline, so they had Gendry be like the child instead that Melisandre needed. They stuck Melisandre in the Riverlands and like wrote in a kind of cool scene with her and Arya. Like like brown eyes, green eyes, and blue eyes, those are just the color that
people's
the
eyes,
color eyes
in.
That people have. Like, yeah. I think that was them transcribing her future as like a faceless man and all the people that she was about to kill, because she already had a couple notches on her kill belt, but she didn't really start diving into that until after the Red Wedding and in season 4.
Her numbers were ballooned. Her stats ballooned after that that season.
Yeah. And I think that what you said was spot on, which is that like they, you know, to take their analogy, like they looked at the pieces on the board and they specifically chose those two scenes that they had invented for the show, for Arya, like the Melisandre scene, but also that quote from Cyrio Farrell is not in the books.
Right.
He never says there is only one God and his name is death. And there is one thing we say to death, not today.
Right.
Benioff and Weiss have talked about that also. There's a book that HBO put out in 2012 called Inside Game of Thrones. They really need to mix up what they call all of these segments, because it's like inside the episode, the game revealed, inside Game of Thrones. But anyways, there's this book, and Benioff, in that, he's asked what scenes or dialogue he was most proud of writing, and he specifically said that Cyrio Farrell moment, because he thought that that was like a perfect showcase of how collaborative Game of Thrones was, because like George R. R. Martin invented Arya and Cyrio, but he didn't write that specific scene. It was one of their other co-writers, I guess. Her name's Jane Espenson. Wrote that scene in for Arya because it was like her way of kind of dealing with the fact that Jory and her father had just been attacked by Jaime Lannister's men. And then Benioff was the one who wrote the dialogue about death. So I think it was very intentional that they picked the things that they had already invented and that belonged to them much more than it belonged to George as their big final moment for the Night King.
$1,000 question. Do you think they are staying away from Martin's material out of respect to give him room to do it? Or do you think this is kind of a little bit of okay, well, you left us with, because like you said,
are they spite writing? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, like I've said many times, like, yeah, like the Double D's did not sign up to write shitty George Martin fan fiction.
Right.
They signed up to adapt in grand lavish style one of the premier science fiction fantasy series that had been written thus far. So do you think is this like give the old man time room to maneuver, or you think it's kind of like, you know what, fuck you, old man, you didn't take out the trash and now we're doing it for you and you can't complain how we do it?
I highly doubt D&D have ever thought fuck you, George, at any point in their lives.
You don't think so?
I mean, here's the thing. I think that
was said multiple times the first writer's room they met and they were out of book material.
I don't know. I think if I was in their position, I would be way more like bummed than angry. Like, that's the thing. This entire situation is just one giant bummer.
Yeah, it's like, unfortunate.
George is bummed. I'm sure HBO was kind of bummed. I'm sure Benioff and Weiss are bummed. All the fans are super bummed from what I can see
George's
on Twitter
publisher.
In the last 72 hours. Like, this isn't how it was supposed to happen.
Nah.
And I think that that just sucks.
Yeah.
And I think that this episode was just the start of that kind of like reckoning that we're about to all go through.
Oh, yeah, God. So
there's such like a sense of ownership, I think, from people who've invested so much time and so much of their emotions in George's writings, and now to see that on screen without him there, I have to imagine that feels very bad for people who've read these books.
Right, because it feels, especially with like the Arya choice, it feels like Benioff and Weiss just opted to toss out all of the intentional foreshadowing that George had telegraphed into the earlier seasons, and go with their own version of what they thought would be coolest or most surprising. Like, that's what bothers me about their reasoning. They're like, oh, John was too obvious. And I'm like, John was only too obvious because his entire arc was like centered around the fight against the White Walkers and like the Night King. So I don't know. I don't necessarily agree that like not having him be the one to do it was the best solution just because they wanted to like surprise people.
Yeah, especially in light of like kind of like Game of Thrones is in large part a reaction to George's childhood fandom of Lord of the Rings, right? And Lord of the Rings, say what you will, like it was obvious that Frodo was going to complete his mission. Like that's what everyone expected. It was subverted when he actually couldn't because he was overcome by the power of the ring, and his chief nemesis in the series, his greed And equal competition for the power of the ring led him to bite his finger off and tumble backwards in the lava. And that's like one of the greatest, most satisfying moments of all time. It feels like the Double D's like, well, if John or Danny do this, it's going to be expected. So we just have to swerve. Like, I mean, I'm not mad that Arya did. I do wish it was a little bit more of a combined arms affair. Like, it would have been nice if somehow Bran's warging, Danny's dragons, and John's Valyrian steel and Arya's assassin abilities would come together. So where it's like, oh, because like the other thing that was kind of neat about The Prince Was Promised is like there was a little bit of flavor from all the different cultures from the world of ice and fire, right? Like Essos tradition had this, Westerosi tradition had this, the First Men said this. Like there are all these different legends. So it could be that like everyone was right. And there's like four princes and princesses that were promised. They all came together, Captain Planet style, to take down this guy. And no, it's just like literally everyone else was ineffectual. Danny had to be saved. John couldn't even fucking kill the one dragon. Bran was just, I don't know, watching weirwood porn the whole time. And Arya puts on her, you know, pulls up her big girl pants and kills the Night King. And like I said, it's fine. It's just like it completely leaves out. So so one thing you said that's kind of poured cold ice water down my spine is the idea that we are ready for... We need to gird ourselves for a recalibration of all of our end expectations, because up until you said that, I was thinking, well, okay, Night King, Double D invention, Arya, you know, this prophecy, like now that it's done, the rest of the stuff with Cersei and King's Landing, that might go kind of according to the plan. But you're saying that like, I mean, yeah, there's no evidence that that's true.
No. And I also think it's very interesting that, like, Benioff and Weiss used to, they would tell us when something happened that George had told them. Like Shireen burning
Hodor.
And Hodor.
Yeah.
They were straight up like, oh, when George said this, we were surprised.
Right.
They said in advance of this season that they aren't going to do that this time around, which makes sense, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I don't know. It's a lose-lose situation again.
Right.
Big fat bummer. Like the tagline, I think, for what's happening.
Right.
So I don't know. Like, I think that what's going to drive me bananas and a lot of fans bananas is that we aren't going to know if what we're seeing was the plan.
So yeah. The Double D's have said that they're not, because like I understand the reason for that, because if they change stuff and people love it, then it makes George look bad. If they change stuff and people hate it, then it looks like that, you know, it makes them look bad. If like it seems like they're throwing themselves or George under their bus. So just like, let's just not talk about it. But you're right. The uncertainty is kind of maddening, because as a fan, it's like, you know, should I stay invested in this stuff? What's going on? You know, like, am I looking forward to When's the Winter coming out? Am I looking forward to Dream of Spring? I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that what by doing that, they are leaving us open to like experience George's story fresh and to potentially be completely surprised by it if or when he's going in a completely different direction. I feel really in the woods right now with these final three episodes. Like I don't feel like I have a handle on what's going to happen, which is a very unusual feeling for me in this show. Yeah. I've spent most, like 98% of my time watching this show feeling very confident that I knew what was going to happen next, either because of leaks, but also just because I felt like I had a good understanding of where the story was headed and like certain character beats that were going to be met. And this episode just kind of tossed a lot of that out the window, and it's disorienting.
Is it a bad disorienting, or is it exciting? Because as a show watcher only, I've been in that position the entire time. And to me, that, you know, those possibilities are exciting, but as a book reader, I can imagine that would be a little frustrating.
I think if I was just like watching the show to watch it, I would be super excited, and it is kind of exhilarating to be like, whoa, like we have almost 4 hours left of this show that's going to be probably like some of the best, most well-produced television in history, and I don't know what's going to happen. That's cool. If the thing that makes it not cool is that it's my job to to write about this show and to like come from a more like expert perspective. And that's like adding a lot of stress right now to my experience with the show, because it's unsettling. And I also just like personally, I hate being wrong about things. And so I'm like, oh my God, I was so wrong about everything that I thought was going to just happen in that battle. And I hate being wrong.
Yeah. I mean, to your point, like I kind of agree that like, I don't think I'm as high as 98%, but most of the times when a show would deviate from where I thought George was going, like in hindsight, I'm like, okay, I understand why they're doing that, because obviously they just can't. There's not enough time to do this plot, so they're going to have to simplify. And this is a pretty smart way to simplify. This is just different for seemingly the sake of being different. Right. And it's also weird because the show has been invested in a lot of these prophecies and paying off things like Jon being a secret Targaryen, and then for them to swerve on this big thing. I don't know. It's a weird intentional thing that I don't understand exactly the intention behind it. And it's going to be, I was going to ask you, what do you think is actually going to happen? Because the same way, like all these grandiose thoughts about like, okay, well, here's the Valonqar and it's probably going to be one of these three people. And it's probably going to end in some, it's, you know, the Iron Throne is going to look like this and it's going to be reformed to be the, I don't honestly. I mean, I still think it's going to have a happy-ish ending. I don't think Cersei's going to win. But other than that, no clue. I don't even know if they're going to pay off the Clegane Bowl.
I feel like that's the one thing that I'm like, oh, okay, if the Hound survived the Battle of Winterfell and they're all heading south, that's the one thing that I'm hoping
but you know what I'm saying?
Partially
like,
right about.
I'm hanging my hat on because the Hound basically went up to the mountain and said, you, me, Clegane Bowl next season. But they also talked about the prince that was promised and the princess that was promised and all that stuff in the same. So like, I don't know. Like if in the 18 months off, if they looked at themselves and say, you know what, that'd be kind of cool, but who cares? And it's going to get in our way of doing something else cool. I have no faith that they are going, that they see that as a promise that they need to keep and fulfill. If they think that they can do something in their minds that's equally cool. And I guess that's where it's like, I don't know that I have faith when Dan and David say, this is going to be something equally as cool, that will be equally as cool to me, because I'm kind of mixed track record of that stuff.
I would say the one thing that I've kind of come to terms with on the prophecy is that like I can see the case to be made for like that thing that Melisandre said on season 7 where she's like, I've brought fire and ice together, like my job is done for now or whatever, and then fucked off to Essos for apparently no reason. The entire stand against the White Walker army and the Night King wouldn't have happened without Daenerys and Jon. Like Arya would not have been able to get to that moment in the Godswood if Jon hadn't like convinced Daenerys to bring her armies north and like fly around on dragons. So I think that they did kind of play a part. I agree that like, I wish Jon is my favorite character and I get so bummed out that he keeps not actually getting a follow through like hero moment. I don't think that he's really done anything awesome since Hardhome. Like, I mean, he's doing cool things, but he always gets saved at the last minute. And with the dragon, I was like, here we go. We're going to get like quintessential fantasy hero stuff because Jon's about to slay a dragon and that's going to be really awesome. And then like he screamed in the dragon's face and then it collapsed.
To kill it with his Valyrian steel, that I still would have felt like that would have been a moment. One thing I found out a couple months ago that you and I have in common is we were both working on Game of Thrones book projects in the off season. I was going to catch up with you. How's that going? Is there any details you're comfortable talking about? And when can people look for it to be released?
Yeah, totally. So my book has a title and a cover, and you can even pre-order it right now. So it's called The Unofficial Guide to Game of Thrones. And I'm about like 75% done with it. I wrote as much as I could during the off season. And then obviously because it encompasses all 8 seasons of the show, I'm now writing as I go for these final episodes. But yeah, you can pre-order it right now on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and IndieBound. If you have like a local bookstore, you can call them and pre-order it. It's going to be out officially on October 8th. So it's a paperback book, $19.99, pretty reasonable price, I think, for what's pretty much a complete comprehensive start to finish look at the show and how it was made. But also, like, you know, my signature insider articles are like all the details that you might have missed. So I literally go through the entire season, and I picked my favorite one from every episode, because I was like, I could write a 500 page book about all the layers.
It encompasses like the filmmaking, the production, post-production, the whole shooting, writing, all that.
I have chapters on like the score and the costumes and some of like the locations. It was actually pretty fun. I got to interview one of the women who works for the Northern Ireland Tourism board, and just like about how, you know, Game of Thrones completely changed the entire economy of Northern Ireland.
Wow.
So that was pretty cool. But then I move into my own like editorializing and like analysis of the series, and different aspects of it. I have a whole section right now on Jon and Dany and the Prince That Was Promised, and I have to rewrite that.
It's going to have to be heavily revised. You're right. Yeah.
I was deeply wrong.
I unfortunately, my book released before the season, so I can't go back and do any control Z-ing. Well, thanks for coming on. I'm excited to see what the book when it comes out.
Thank you.
I appreciate all the work that you do on Insider for not just show, but you've been so solid for a lot of the shows we've covered, like Westworld. Were you also on Mr. Robot, doing Mr. Robot type
stuff?
No. What was the other one I was thinking of?
I did Dark, which of course that's coming back in June. And I was like, can you not release this show right after Game of Thrones?
Yeah.
I have things to do. Yeah, all sorts of stuff. But thank you. That means a lot. That's really awesome. Thank you for having me, too. This is always fun.
No, hopefully we can coordinate and collaborate on some stuff in the future. But thanks for stopping by.
Yeah, I'd love that.
Kimmerin, for everybody. Guys. You can find her on Insider. Check out especially her Game of Thrones work and be looking for her book, The Unofficial... you say it's an unofficial guide to...
Yeah.
Game of Thrones?
Yeah, Unofficial Guide to Game of Thrones.
Out October 8th and available for pre-order now. Before we get to feedback, just want to mention that this podcast is sponsored by Bombfell. And guys, when it comes to clothes, looking acceptable is pretty easy for us. We just go khakis and button-downs for work, suit and tie for wedding and funerals, and jeans and t-shirts for pretty much everything else. But what if you want to do more than look acceptable? What if you want to look good? What if you want to look, dare I say, great? Finding a great style that suits you and complements your coloring and shape is tough, and who can keep up with it? Well, Bombfell is an easier way for men to get better clothes. It's fully personalized. Every piece has been handpicked for you by your own stylist. Your stylist will email you their selections, after which you have about 2 days to make any changes or even cancel altogether. Then you receive the clothes. You have 7 days to tell them what you want to keep, and then you can send the rest back. You can receive clothes when you want and pause and cancel at any time. For the clothes you keep, they've got a tiered reward system. If you keep 2+ items, you get 10% off. 3+ items, 50% off. 4+ items, you get 20% off. The more you keep, the more you save. I signed up for Bombfell and was matched with Melissa as my stylist. After selecting styles that best represented me from dozens of options and inputting my sizes, Melissa set me up with a nice outfit consisting of pants, a long tee, and a pullover. And I liked them all, but I actually had a Henley in almost exactly the same color and style as the tee, so she substituted a cool kind of refugee from Zion and the Matrix kind of top. Just a few days later, I was trying on my new fit. I gotta say, not only did I enjoy the more dapper dork look that I had, but I received quite a few random compliments. Everything fit excellently and was comfortable enough for a full day at the studio, too. Bombfell has given us an exclusive deal for listeners of Bald Move, so you can get $25 off your first purchase. Just visit bombfell.com/GOT. That's BOMBFELL.com/GOT. No promo required. Just visit bombfell.com/GOT. That's Bombfell, open and close.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Let's get to feedback, Jim. As always, you can send that in to GameOfThrones@baldmove.com or discuss it with your fellow fans on forums.baldmove.com as well. A couple things, I guess, before I get to feedback. There's some things that I collectively wanted to talk about because there's just a lot of variations of the theory that things aren't over with the Night King.
Okay. Is this wishful thinking on the part of fans of the series, or does this have a lot of weight to it?
Well, that's the thing. Some of them do. Like, I'm going to consider a couple of them. Some of them, I think, maybe, like, I know. I honestly, after, because the thing is like, these things don't occur in a vacuum, and if you heard for, like, our conversation with Kim, after that, I'm actually even more on the side of, like, the Double Ds are just going to do their own thing this season, have some fun, do some spectacle, and get the hell out of here so they can get onto their Star Wars trilogy.
Yeah.
I think that if in a universe where, like, the behind the scenes of episodes of Game of Thrones don't exist and you can't hear their own words saying, you know, this is what we wanted to do and we wanted to subvert this and this is what we thought would be cool, then maybe. But, like, we do live in that world, so I don't find it very persuasive, but it's a possibility. I think what's really happening is you've got, like, this is the denial stage of some of these people's grief and the coming to grips with the fact that, like, this isn't going to go the way we hoped it was going to go, or maybe we thought it was going to go to because of our pet theories or whatever. Like, I think it's more of that, but maybe some of them are at least interesting to talk about. But there's one in particular that was in the feedback and I've seen going around Reddit, is that John shouted go during his final confrontation with the dragon, which
a Pokemon
which gave Arya a split second to sneak past the dragon. because there's a lot of people that's problem with Arya killing is the fact that she
they want the assist from Jon.
Yeah, they want to somehow, they're like, okay, somehow the one of the princes or princesses that were promised need to get involved in here, and they're looking for a way. There's a couple scenes that I rewatched to verify some feedback. First of all, I think this is just not...
Is it in the subtitles?
No.
Okay, well, I think that's your answer.
Yeah. I don't think it was intended. It's... No. I'm sorry. That's...
Subtitles are pretty definitive, I think.
That's certainly wishful thinking. But then, some of these other Night King kind of reboot theories we'll talk about in the fullness of time. Charlie F. has a point. I want to bring to light another book call out in this episode, just like last episode of The Jenny of Old Stones. When Lyanna Mormont has her last stand with the giant having a blue eye because he's a white, I feel like the focus on his eye was a hinting to the blue eye of Macumber legend in the books. Nice little touch of Westeros theology.
I have never heard of this story.
Well, this is funny. This is a funny story because when Anthony and I were writing the books, we were like brainstorming like all the different connections as we were breaking each chapter, and we're doing the one on the Night King and the others and like the relations to North mythology. And at the time, if you recall, we had just played through like God of War, mm-hmm. which is all about like a tour of the Norse mythology, and you know that there's the legend is there's this particular giant that died and like the world is formed from his corpse, and there's like a level in God of Thrones God of War
where this is all very confusing with the naming,
right, where you're like traversing through this giant's body and into his skull and all that stuff, and how that like me and Anthony like, oh, that kind of ties into the Macumber theory, which we had turns out we had the, you know, the moment where people like find out Berenstain Bears is spelled differently than they think, and instead of thinking, oh, I was wrong, you actually envision an entire universe where all these, we had, because like we swore that this was something that had to do with the books, and it was a sly reference to Martin, who himself has blue eyes, like that this is all contained within a giant, so this all came out of his head. And I started like researching and I realized that it was all bullshit. Like, there's one line in the show where they talk about, like, I think it's Tyrion and Jaime talk about, like, oh, maybe the world... And there's none of that in the books. George Martin has brown eyes, not blue eyes. Like, everything that we were starting to build this theory on was completely based on bullshit. Mm-hmm. So I'm not making fun of you, Charlie. I'm just sharing in your...
This sounds like the gaffe that we made last spoiler podcast.
Yeah.
Confusing the names of people, right? Like, oh, well, you take a piece of information, you run with it, not realizing the root of that information is flawed.
Right. Yes,
and
exactly.
And then you extrapolate all these different worlds that could exist. And
it's like you remember Macumber, and it's a weird reference from the show, so you assume it must be in the books. And then if it's in the books, then it's like, well, that'd be an interesting author self-insert. And, of course, why wouldn't Martin have blue eyes? I don't know. I can't remember ever seeing his eyes. He's a squinty kind of guy. But yeah, no, it's all bullshit. Hmm. So just want to put that out there in case anyone else has that brain worm. Okay, Matt M., during the Long Night, where were the Knights of the Vale? I didn't see them or Jon Royce on the battlefield. Do you think they're kept in reserve, which might have made sense? Have them hidden a short distance from Winterfell when the Night King forces were engaged the castle's walls. They come around, attack from the rear.
You mean somebody with a cavalry knows what to do with cavalry?
Yeah, yeah. Royce was in episode 2, so I assume they're still around. I mean, you saw them on the battlefield. There was tons of those shields with the bird, mm-hmm. the hawk, the eagle sigil of the Vale. Mm-hmm. So they were there. It's just they weren't on horseback for some reason, or maybe they were like in the middle of the Dothraki crowd. That it's like, you know, fought in because
they got swept up in the fervor too,
or maybe the Double D's forgot that the Vale's actually a lot of mounted cavalry. I don't know. Julie J., did you notice what looks like Alys Stark going into the Godswood of the Ironborn? If so, it looks like the Karstarks are also finished along with the Mormonts and Umbers, and we assume the Glovers, even if the North is given independence, there won't be anyone left. That would be a funny mm-hmm. thing if the succession thing is solved by Dany letting Jon be the king of the North, and he has like three people. Mm-hmm. It's him and Arya and Bran and Sansa.
Yeah.
So... No, I actually watched this scene too, and I think I know maybe a person or two you could be talking about, but it's dark and it's hard to tell, and it's a scene in motion, so I don't know why Alys Karstark would be fighting with the Ironborn, but I also think we're to understand that, the North is just fucking I mean, decimated is, that's just killing that's one out of 10. Yeah. It's like ninth-imated.
Right.
It's like 90% of the people have been are dead. And, you know, I think it's because a lot of people are like, oh, what do you do without these gray houses? And I'm like, well, there's a precedent because it's pretty clear that, like, in the other Long Night, this happened again. And all these houses that are of, like, great renown, like the Stark, I mean, who knows? They all these gray houses could have been, like, cadet branches of the Starks or, like, maybe even the Starks weren't that big. These are all just a bunch of, like, loosely affiliated First Men kings banding together children of the forest. And they later became the Starks and the Glovers and the Umbers. So, you know, give them a few thousand years. Maybe they'll get into skyscrapers and they'll invent democracy and they won't have kings and queens anymore. But I don't know how much they're actually going to give weight. Like, is there going to ever be a point in a story where, like, the show itself reflects about, like, God damn, 90% of North is just gone now.
I mean, I would hope it would be next episode if ever.
Yeah. Or, like, maybe a final episode where they deal with... I mean, because there's still some people saying, like, yeah, oh, well, the Double Ds want to pay off Martin's attempts to, like, wanting to know what happened after Aragorn started. No, that's clearly not going to happen, right?
Is there time to do that?
You're not going
to
get a 60-minute episode of just Queen Daenerys' tax policy and how she integrates...
You would need a whole other season for that.
The remaining Northerners and Wildlings and Dothraki into some united Northern culture. It's just...
Well, what about a flash forward? What about a 1,000-year flash forward?
There you go.
And we see what the tree that the roots of Dany have grown.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know.
That seems like a bad way to take the series out.
Yeah, I could... I thought about something really funny to say, but... It would involve spoiling Endgame, and that tends to get people salty the first with that not even been out for a week.
Yeah.
Let's move on to Albert H. Is the downfall of the Night King, in the downfall of the Night King, he and his generals scattered into ice cubes, and it seems all the whites just collapsed. If I remember correctly, Viserion also crumpled into a heap. Would there be a possibility in future episodes that they would harvest materials from the ice dragon? How badass would it be to have Arya in some awesome ice dragon leather armor? How many swords and dagger hilts could be made from the ice dragon bones? The possibilities are endless of what you can create from that dead dragon.
Let me ask you this. Which do you think is sturdier?
Uh-huh.
Dragon ice or dragon glass?
Probably dragon glass, right?
I would think so, yeah.
Because
you can take dragon glass into the heat.
Yeah, it's
dragon
true.
Ice,
that's
just
true.
It'll just melt.
Yeah, you just need to be a room temperature to defeat that.
Yeah, shit, my armor's melting again. I got to get in the ice box.
This does sound like some kind of weird Skyrim mod.
It really does, yeah.
Right? Like, let Arya wear ice dragon armor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know,
I mean,
this was...
Shit, man, Bethesda should just freaking make a Game of Thrones game.
I'm surprised.
That could be amazing.
I'm surprised there haven't been more Game of Thrones video games.
There have been attempts, but they're not great.
Yeah, and then it's like the Telltale stuff, which is essentially a storybook, you know, choose your own adventure. And there's
been
a couple mobile apps, I think. Mm-hmm. But like, yeah, why can't we get a Battle of the Five Kings?
I think it'd be awesome.
I've spawned several really excellent board games, I thought. But like, it seems like there should be a real-time tactical or strategic thing or something like that. But... Vanessa W., I'd started a draft last week of a comment I had about Dany, but after episode 3, I'm just throwing up my hands and saying, what the F? Arya kills the Night King. We have all that buildup about Jon's parentage, all the references to Azor Ahai, all the deaths of characters like Jojen, Reed, and Shireen, and for what? Nothing? Rhaegar's belief that he needed a third child to be the head of the dragon, that he needed to father the prince that was promised, leading to Robert's rebellion, and ultimately the downfall of so many great houses was for nothing. All the lore from Gurm's books just gets thrown out the window. We know nothing about the Night King's motives, but apparently that's not important because he was some meaningless bad guy. I think we talked about this in the Kim Renfro interview, but like, if not, this is an off-air conversation we had where she pointed out, it's like, okay, pump the brakes. It's not that this didn't matter, because without Dany and Jon, Arya would not have the chance. Like, so if you want the, like, by our powers combined, if not for Arya, if not for Bran, if not for Jon, none of these things would have occurred in the same place to allow Arya to strike with her knife. So they've already been our powers combined. They just happened over the previous 7 seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a fine take if you want to step back and be like, okay, it's not as bad as we all think. But then Katie had some interesting ideas of how maybe with a little bit of dialogue in the next episode that this could be a little bit more lore happy or lore friendly. She says, do you think the dagger will play the same role in the book? She's talking about the cat's paw dagger that Bran got and then gave to Arya. Mm-hmm. The path of the dagger is probably one of the most successfully executed aspects of the story that weaves throughout the entire series. The mirroring of the knife sent to Bran or kill Bran being the knife that saves Bran is great. The fact that Littlefinger uses the knife as a linchpin that he pulls to start the whole War of the Five Kings and is ultimately executed by that same knife for his crimes is very satisfying. It would certainly bring make sense if this is how it goes down in the books. But the last we hear of the knife in the books is Cersei, Tyrion, and Jaime have come to the conclusion that Joffrey sent it to kill Bran, parenthetically, to impress his father. Of course, this doesn't necessarily make it true because we don't get hard proof. Do you think the knife ultimately has the same greater meaning in A Song of Ice and Fire and have the double D's credit to the path of the dagger to Gurm? And I have one more email that chains off this one to make it even more awesome. But if you want to stop and comment here, that's cool.
Let's hear the extension on it too.
So Jenny's contribution is, I have to share a great book theory that could possibly play into the show. There is a theory that the Valyrian dagger is actually all that's left of the sword Darksister, which was one of the famed Targaryen blades. You have Blackfyre, which is the main one that Aegon wielded, and then his warrior sister, Visenya, wielded Darksister. As you might know, Visenya is Arya's hero, and she speaks of her when talking to Tywin about when she was his cupbearer. Not only is Arya truly the Darksister of House Stark, but also she's the last known whereabouts of the blade was that it was owned by Brendan Rivers, who, of course, is the Three-Eyed Raven that trained Bran. And I first thought, like, when I got these emails, I'm like, a dagger? Like, we're talking about, like I don't think, Darksister wasn't a great sword, but it's like a hand and a half type of bastard sword. It's like, how the fuck do you get a dagger out of that? But I remember what they did to Ned Sword Ice.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's not, like, I was thinking, like, what is, like, a broken sword? Like, that Narsil sword from Lord of the Rings that gets,
oh, like, you just, like, yeah, cut a piece of it
like
off?
Like, there's a shard of it, but, like...
Yeah, you can melt it down and reforge it.
Or even if it is, like, a shard, I'm thinking, like, well, it'd have this big... But no, they could take the hilt off and just work that into a new blade. If you're looking for kind of, like, overarching... If you want to tell yourself a story of how all this stuff matters and is more connected...
Yeah.
There, I think there's a nice little plot there. And I also think there is a small chance that maybe there will be some reflecting of that in this next kind of... I'm assuming this next episode is going to be like a pause to catch your breath to set up the next epic thing, the Southern War type of episode. Maybe?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting theory. I think certainly the first part of that duo of emails I 100% agree with. I think this knife has been, you know, a key pivotal... played a pivotal role in the entire series so far, and it's kind of impressive how they've woven that through the story.
Yeah,
I think it's even cooler if it turns out to be that, you know, Brendan as this previous Three-Eyed Raven is doing this multi-generational sort of scheming. You know, he's putting the dagger in the right place to where it needs to be. Maybe not, you know, physically or not with his own hand, but he's maneuvering things sort of like Bran maneuvers things to get to the end point that he sees. I think that's even cooler. And if they can do something to kind of tell us that through Bran in the show in the next few episodes, then that would be awesome.
And that's the thing, because, like, you know, there's also theories about the Three-Eyed Raven has been at work for almost a century trying to guide the Targaryen dynasty to the point that they would be able to produce, you know, the prince that was promised, and also the maneuver of this new Three-Eyed Raven in his place. Like, there's a lot of really cool stuff there. The problem is, like, I can see all these pieces laying on the floor, but I'm not going to pick them up and put them together for Dan and David.
No, they, like, have to do that.
Because otherwise, they're just kids playing with toys, and they threw them down on the ground in an interesting pattern, you know? Like...
Sure.
Like, the show... Like, and it's so weird, because there's a tension between, you know, we're always saying, well, we prefer when shows show, not tell. But sometimes you got to tell. Sometimes you got to pat yourself on the back and say, like, oh, look at this smart thing I did.
Yeah, but showing is also telling in most circumstances, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're both conveying information. Right. It's just how you convey that information. And so far, they haven't... They have tried to convey that first piece of information, but not the theories that we're talking about in the second half of that.
Right. I mean, because, like, you know, the fact that this dagger started the war...
Yeah.
ended the Great War, killed Littlefinger.
It's awesome. I love it.
it's awesome. But like, again, I think the show, if they intended that, they need to kind of like take their hat off and wave it around a bit. So, or else there's going to be if you have to get all this shit from an insider article, then the vast, vast majority of the people are not going to see it and appreciate it, you know? But if you have to read this on a Reddit post, you know?
Did we need to, though? I mean, I thought it tracked pretty cleanly. This dagger is a very recognizable weapon.
But you say that
because
you host a podcast where we've been talking about it for weeks.
Probably.
You know, so, like you know, we've got one of the bigger podcasts on the planet, but for Game of Thrones, but it's still, like, not even a percentage, 1% of the total fan base from last season, you know? So,
right.
So,
for
like,
Game of Thrones, certainly.
Yeah, I do think that it should be a little bit more accessible. And they just needed a throwaway line. They needed, like, maybe this would be super cheesy because I'm not a great filmmaker, but like a cascading, like, Sixth Sense style flashback right as Arya's slow motion jumping through the Night King of, like, the first time we see the and it getting pulled from Kat's hands, and then it's here and there, and it's given here, and
seeing Bran's vision, seeing as he realizes what's happening,
yeah,
maybe through his visions,
against, like all like, yeah, yeah.
You could certainly do that.
You could do something like that, and with Ramin Djawadi's music and the loving care that the filmmaker, like I said, I think you could do something that would then make it from the 1% enjoying it to like, oh, the vast majority of the fan base is going to roll in and be like, hot damn, that fucking dagger was dynamite. How brilliant that they weaved all that through there. Okay, let's move on. Tiang M. For years now, the general reaction of the White Walkers, or I'm sorry, the general reading on the White Walkers is that the dead is that they're a metaphor for some impending global doom. For example, climate change, coming to wipe us out while we're all too busy with our petty squabbles to do anything real about it. But I think with the way the Double D's chose to end the Night King and his horde, Game of Thrones starts to ask another question. What are the prophecies and religious hype around mythical figures like Azor Ahai and the Last Hero, prophesied to single-handedly save the realm, were the real distraction? White, this is a text joke, it doesn't work. And on you know, homophones don't
work. W-H
yeah.
versus W-I.
Exactly,
okay.
There you
gotcha.
Go. They're white noise, if you will. What if both sides are equally distracted? One is too busy playing the game to realize the apocalypse is on them, while the other is too busy dissecting theories and prophecies about who will sit or stop the apocalypse instead of actually doing something to try to stop it. It's a Gurmian subversion. All your fan theories and dissecting of prophecies from books old and new and putting faith in the mythical ideas got the living nowhere. What actually saved them was a pragmatic badass warrior that spent the last 7 seasons training with the world's greatest fighters, picking up a Valyrian steel dagger and saying, not today. What do you think of that, Jim? Mm-hmm.
I suppose that's one way to look at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird because, you know, Arya is not just like this conventional badass fighter. She's not a Jaime Lannister. She's essentially a magical being at this point.
Right.
So you look at that and say, well, okay, is there really a waste of time to try and dissect all these prophecies if there are forces in this world like that? But yeah, I suppose you could look at it that way.
I guess it's kind of the way when I was reading this email, I was thinking about the people that I'm sure we all know, hell, I'm one of them, that we spend a lot of time thinking about and learning new things about climate change, or like we're not happy with the political realities we're facing, but are we doing anything about it? You know, like sometimes like all that intellectual kind of masturbation that kind of leads to this weird apathy can be just as, and like, whereas a person just being like, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to do my part. I'm going to, you know, like, I'm going to take this direct action. I'm going to clean up my corner of the street, or I'm going to start taking my cans recycling. It doesn't really matter. But if everyone did that, it would certainly matter. And the fact that not everyone's doing it is the reason that everyone doesn't do it. So
I think it's a little different here because it does take, it kind of takes the heroes. And if you want to say, okay, well, the heroes are the people analogous to the people in our world who are in a position to actually do something about this, right? Government leaders, executives at companies who are, you know, actively destroying the planet, things like that. Then you can look at the common person in Game of Thrones or our world and say, yeah, it doesn't actually matter. And no matter how many of us were out there, like, taking a sword to a single white,
right,
it would never matter.
Right.
Because more whites are being made. It really takes those heroes, those people who are in a position to do something about it, to step up and kill the Night King.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you've got to fix the problem at its root. You can't simply say, well, I'll pitch in and do my part.
Right.
You do have to do that, but you also have to stab my white. How many whites have you stabbed today? Oh,
right.
Three? I got four. Uh-huh.
Right. Meanwhile, Arya can stab them all.
Yeah, with one stab.
Right.
So,
GM, the CEO of GM, could stab like 7% of the world's whites.
For sure.
Chooses not to.
He does.
Or she. I don't know.
I don't know.
Either way, you got to wonder why. Why aren't they doing that? You know, you look at the oil executives. You look at any of the, like, there's a stat that, like, 47% of the world's pollution comes from, like, the top 100 companies.
That makes sense.
Those 100 people could end half of the pollution. I mean, obviously, they couldn't completely end it without destroying the economy. But I don't know. I mean, they're the Aryas in this situation. What? They're just picking their teeth with them Valyrian daggers. This is a very interesting email. Chris A., I first direct you to this tweet sent by Vladimir Furtick, the actor who plays the Night King, that was sent early Sunday morning, hours before the episode aired. I'm not sure if you saw this, but it's a tweet where the guy says, and again, this is the stunt coordinator guy who ended up playing the Night King, says, how did the Night King change Craster's babies? By touching them. How did he change Viserion? By touching him. Mm. What did the Blood Raven say to Bran Stark in the cave? He touched you. Food for thought. Kind of giving another subtext of the Night King being like a child molester.
Okay, this is weird.
It is weird, right? Like, it's like it kind of tracks if you want to go with that. Like, mm-hmm. this is an evil person touching and robbing things of their innocence or their perceived purpose or their potential. It's kind of a pessimistic way to look at the victims of child abuse, that, like, they're fucked now.
Yeah, they're just forever
white walkers, but
forever scarred.
But it is interesting to think about. Chris continues, I, like you, have questions about what Bran was up to in his warg state. I also felt like the Night King's narrative fell a bit flat if this is truly the last we see of him. I'm not sure I 100% bought the motivations Bran stated for the Night King as the sole motivators. I needed more backstory about the Night King and why he's been on the journey through the season. Plus, I felt like this finale, while amazing, was a tad abrupt at the end of the battle in which his army had been so dominant.
Well, whether you believe it or not, you kind of have to go with what they put on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, that is what they put on screen. They may put something else on screen, something more. I don't know. But so far, I take Bran at his word.
Right. And I just keep on going back to this and put it back. Not to blame Gurm, but to, like, show that, like, look, in the books, we know much less about the White Walkers than we do in the show. And there is no Night King, and there is no... It's entirely possible that the Double Ds maybe, by not making decisions earlier in the season, the series, to try... Because, like, again, they had to invent something, right? The easiest thing in the world is to invent a Death Star exhaust port. Mm-hmm. Like, there's an unbeatable thing that's absolutely going to kill the heroes. They can't do dick about it, but it's got a fatal flaw. Like, this is storytelling kind of 101. It's kind of, you know, it's so hackneyed now that you kind of got to layer it up with a bunch of other different things that draw people's attention from the fact that you're essentially pushing a destruct button on this doomsday weapon. But that's one of the only ways you can resolve these type of, like, unstoppable, insurmountable things. You give the humans a smaller scale thing that they can reasonably achieve through great odds and sacrifice, because just beating the person in a straight up fight is never going to work. I would like to see George do... I'm not even saying this snarkily. I would like to see George do better, because I don't even know that George has really got, like, how this is going to work in his mind. I think he knows how he wants things to end and how he wants people to react to that ending, but, like, how is Jon and Dany going to beat the Night King? You know, they can't just fly dragons up there and incinerate them all. That's going to feel like bullshit. I mean, it's tough. There's a reason the man stopped writing books 8 years ago.
Yeah.
Like, this collapsing this giant fucking story back in and getting it to a singularity that is the finish of the ice Song of Ice and Fire is a really tough challenge that is so far beyond the creator of the damn series himself.
It's easier to write books about the history of the universe that he's created.
Yeah.
Fill in some gaps.
Yeah. Okay, we got another pair of kind of emails that go together. Olivia M. sets it up. I was surprised in the past seven seasons that we've been working towards the Battle of Winterfell and somehow ended in a victory for the living with all of our favorite characters, including the big ones, and still intact. The first episode of the series began with the White Walkers, and it's been a huge plot line that's been brewing for the entire series. If the Night King plot ends here, then we are left with some holes in the plots that Game of Thrones has been working on for a while. And she mentioned several that we've kind of talked about already. The Azor Ahai prophecy. This prophecy is about someone with Lightbringer who ends the Long Night. Arya did not have to kill anyone, nor that she loved, nor was a dagger she used on fire. People have been predicting that Jon will kill Dany or vice versa, but again, this prophecy doesn't have to do with the throne, but the Long Night. And Dany's visions, Dany has a vision of the throne room covered in snow. I guess it could signify Jon, but in my opinion, it would be a far reach. Okay, so Melissa then comes in with some ideas for how we can make these prophecies still be significant. She says, if Jon is the prince that was promised, which the show seems to be leaning into, where is his Lightbringer? Okay, that's another thing that I don't think we've actually talked about, but that's been a big part of this show. Lightbringer, Lightbringer, Lightbringer. Where's the fucking Lightbringer? We didn't see, like, is the dagger Lightbringer?
It's possible.
I believe in this show's version, his Lightbringer is not a sword Longclaw, but a person, his little sister slash cousin Arya. So this has been a popular theory that that maybe one way to resolve the prince's promise, and you've got two princes and princes, is that one will be Lightbringer, the physical manifestation of the weapon to destroy the White Walker, and one will be the Azor Ahai, the person who, quote-unquote, wields it. And there's been various versions of that, that Jon is the Lightbringer to Dany, that Dany's the Lightbringer to Jon, that Dany's dragons are collectively Lightbringers, et cetera, but here's Melissa's version. Jon is the one who gave Arya Needle, which caused Ned to decide to hire Cyril Ferrell to train her. I know the Not Today line is the most famous, but in episode 1-3, Cyril calls her boy. She retorts, I'm a girl. Then Cyril said the important thing for this theory to work out. Boy, girl, you are a sword. We go through a tutelage under Yoren and the Hound. We get to Braavos. What was the one thing that Arya couldn't bring herself to part with when she was told that she'd have to give up everything from her Stark identity? Of course.
Her face. Oh, that's not it. Her sword.
Yeah. She didn't bury her face under a rock, Jim. She buried her sword Needle.
Obviously.
Now, I know the prophecy is about how Lightbringer is forged is pretty specific. It's tempered first in water, then it's tempered in the heart of a lion, then finally in the heart of Azor Ahai's wife, Nyssa. Arya's first training was water dancing. Well, there's the water. She then had to escape King's Landing and went on the run from the Lannisters, even getting captured by them and escaping again from the lion. But the blade through the heart? The only person that's taken a knife through the heart that's currently walking around is Jon. That stab is what allowed him to break the Night's Watch vows and for him and Sansa to be able to take Winterfell back. Arya had no intention of going to Winterfell until she heard Jon was there. Arya loves Jon just about more than she loves anyone, and the very first thing she said to him when they reunited was, how did you survive the knife to your heart?
Oof.
I know this will be different in the books and that the showrunners decided a few years ago that Arya would be the one to kill the Night King for reasons they haven't yet stated, but if one were to need to reverse engineer a good way to make the prophecies, which they've mentioned as recently as episode 702 work, there's a pretty good argument that Jon is the prince that was promised, put his unparalleled weapon to end the Long Night on her path to be able to bring back the dawn.
Wow. Again. Not to shit too hard on this.
Okay. All right.
But if you're not on board with them having told a very obvious and coherent story about this blade throughout the series, you're definitely not going to follow what they're doing here.
Yeah.
This is a very convoluted theory. Extremely.
It's I think it's clean and it tracks and it has a lot of textual evidence, but yeah. Again, there's a lot of toys here on the floor.
Looking at the episodes, I would never have pulled that out, which I think is, you know, let's say hypothetically that this theory is true. I think that's a failure of the show in that case.
Yeah.
Because I'm not picking up what they're putting down.
Especially Cyril Ferrell, you're not a boy, girl, you are a sword. Like,
I mean, I like that line, and it does track in the theory that you built up here.
Yeah.
but connecting all those dots would be very difficult.
It's tricky because I want to say to give full credit to that, that Arya would have to refer to herself as a sword, or someone else would have to refer to her as a sword a couple other times in the series, but there's a fine line between foreshadowing and giving away the plot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like even some really clever twists that like George put into the series very early that people eventually guessed, like the fact that Jon is actually a secret Targaryen. I mean, that stayed fairly well hidden for a long time before it became accepted as the capital T truth. And then that was really fucking subtle. But like once you get again, a million minds pulling these things over. So I don't know, but them's the breaks. Like, I don't think it's fair to like bury something in the third episode and then 8 seasons later say, ah, remember when Syrio called her the sword? That means she's Lightbringer. And I mean, they can do that, but they have to do a bunch of work in this next episode to have that all tie together.
That's the thing. Like with this 3-stage reveal, you can keep it subtle for a while, but eventually you got to hit me with it.
I mean,
and it has to make sense.
It would be nice to have somebody say, what the fuck was like anyone like, cause you know, I'm thinking of like Varys, Tyrion, Missandei, Dany, Jon, all of the inner circle has been personally a witness to people talking about the Zora High prophecy. Mm-hmm. Like when Melisandre came and did it like in front of Dany's throne room, like shouldn't someone be thinking, someone say, well, like, what the fuck was this all about?
Yeah.
You know?
Just have another hearth scene where they're all sitting around and go, so which of us do you think was the Zora High?
Right, right. And the problem,
let them argue over it.
The other problem is like, cause there's a lot of feedback that I didn't include involving, people saying, cause I think we had a feedbacker already mentioned this as a throwaway sentence, but like people are saying like, oh, well the Prince's Promise was going to be the thing that like united the person that unites Westeros. And I'm like, no, that's fucking bullshit, because the Prince's Promise is thousands of year old prophecy about, or Azor Ahai, rather, about like the person who's going to defeat the White Walkers when they come back, when the Long Night comes back again. Like, it's not about some petty political thing.
Right.
And if so, Aegon the Conqueror was already Azor Ahai, because he united Westeros and kept it together for like 300 years. So,
Melisandre just can't let this prophecy go.
Yeah, yeah.
It's already been fulfilled. She's looking for that second stage fulfillment of the prophecy.
Yeah. I don't know, how old is she? Because there's like theories that she's hundreds of years old. Like, is she
okay?
I can't tell you right off the top of my head. Is like if the most popular theories put her pre Aegon, but it'd be funny if she like missed it and she just can't get over it. Like,
she was only like 4 at the time.
Right.
She really wanted that to be within her adult lifetime.
Saw her other sister like accurately call Aegon, and like, you know, just stuck in her craw. Should have been me. Okay, Matt has a couple questions for us. Do you think that the person who kills the Night King was one of the bullet points from Gurm? I can't imagine that wouldn't be one of the main plot points that he left up to the double D's. I don't think it is. There is no Night King in the book. I don't think, like George, when they first brought up the Night King, you remember he had a whole blog about like, there is a Night King in my book, but there's not exactly a Night King and things are going to be different. But like, people were trying to like read those tea leaves back in the day, but it seems like now that we know everything that's happened, like that was a pretty strong disavowal.
Hmm.
Like, yeah, nah, this part, all this stuff, the white wall, all this, is, don't expect to see it in the books. Matt continues, do you think that there's sufficient foreshadowing in the book so far to make this a thematically satisfying conclusion to the Night King storyline? Again, Night King not in the story, but if we talk about the terms of the others, I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm in a no-win situation, because let's say that George had intended for Arya to kill the Night King the entire time. I mean, it's not like there's no textual evidence there. It's not like that would be a complete, like, out of left wing, but I feel like it probably would be developed better, because that's kind of like, you know, George does take us like time, and you know, he can bury things in words a lot easier. He can bury something in front of the camera, but he hasn't done it right. He might never. Like every year that passes from this point forward, I say that the likelihood of him finishing the series drops off like another 50%. So like in 10 years, hints, we're going to be talking about fractional percentages of chances of this getting finished. I mean, Was there enough foreshadowing in the show for this? Matt continues. Many people have pointed out that the sneaky assassin is what Arya spent the last few seasons of the show training to be. There wasn't any history between her and Dead Dose. Was this still a satisfying conclusion?
I think maybe there was a more satisfying conclusion in there somewhere.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say that this was dissatisfying. I think they have done enough with Arya to make me think that she might be, in fact, the only one who really stood a chance against the Night King. I saw somebody point out how the Night King had like superhuman reaction times and prowess, physical prowess. Like, I don't know that Jon could take him in a one-on-one fight, period. No matter whether he's Azor Ahai or he has Lightbringer or not.
Even if all he has to do is touch him with the blade. That's...
Yeah, I mean, this guy is... We saw how fast he is,
true.
Right? Like, Arya barely, with her stealth assassin skills, got in there and did the job. And it was only really with this one move that, you know, came back and was a nice callback. But I don't know that Jon can do that. I don't know that fucking Beric could have done that, or Jaime or the Hound or anybody.
Yeah, even the last hero... the Legend of the Last Hero said that he needed like 13 companions plus, like, all accounts. There's this verbiage about all accounts agree that it was their alliance with the Children of the Men, Children of the Forest, that kind of like swung the tide of the battle. So like, you needed a village to defeat the first time. Plus, you needed to ally with a bunch of mystical tree based warlocks and witches. So,
And Arya is as close as we have to that now.
Sure,
well, except
Bran,
for Bran.
Yeah.
Who helped, I think.
Something.
He gave him the only weapon he has, which is the stare.
It would be nice. Like, I would laugh out loud if someone in a future episode accuses Bran of doing nothing, and he does, like, that Leonard Nimoy, like, didn't I? I mean, that he can just, like, I was like, my eyes were milky white the whole battle. Yeah. Are you sure I did do nothing, John? John, whose dragon reared up for no fucking good reason, sort of biting your head off. John, oh, I did nothing. Okay.
And then Sansa says, God damn it, Bran, you never help with the dishes. And he says, don't I?
Yeah.
And his eyes roll back.
Right. How do you know your scullery maid would have done the dishes tonight had not been for my influence, my guiding hand?
But yeah, I do think there are potentially more satisfying arcs out there for other characters, being the killer of the Night King, but I did not have a problem with the way they went.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think that most people are disappointed because George has talked a lot of shit about Tolkien specifically for this, like having these faceless, ultimately evil, no shades of gray, no shades of light, like, or no shades of black, or just shades of gray is what I'm trying to say. And the show did not subvert that part at all. Like, the Night King died more or less a face of evil with a stated purpose to just destroy everything that's light and warm and living about the world.
And you know, to the we have emails here that speak to this. People, I think, are dissatisfied that there wasn't more to the Lightbringer stuff, more to the Azor Ahai prophecies. And I kind of don't blame them for that. Like, I say what you want about... maybe it'll be different in the books, but in the show, they made a big deal about the prophecies.
Right.
You can expect that people are going to want to see how those prophecies came true.
Right.
And if they subvert that part of it as well, you're going to have some mad people.
I mean,
it's
expectations, right? The reason that, like, No Man's Sky was panned, like, if that thing just came out for $20 on Steam with no fanfare, people would be like, holy fucking shit, look at this, it's the new Minecraft.
Yeah, and I bet they'll expand on it, and this is going to be awesome someday.
But when they promise the moon and give you a moon rock, people get pissed. when George comes out and says, you know, yeah, Tolkien's great, and I don't want to take anything away from him, but yada-da-da-da-da-da, and you look at Tolkien and be like, okay... Sauron didn't want to destroy all of humanity. He wanted to. He was jealous of him and the boss before him was jealous of the creative powers of God and wanted to create their own race of people to prove that they could do just as good a job and rule over them. It's a one to one. You know, I know Tolkien says this was an allegory, but it's kind of a satanic allegory, right? Like, that is a lot more rich than what we have with the Night King, because the orcs, say what
for
you
sure.
want, the orcs, they had culture, they could speak. They had desires. When Sauron wasn't there with their lidless wreath flame eye and the whip, they had their own devices and their own games and their own sport. Like, that's better in every way than what we got with the Night King and the White Walkers. Now, the books, George could pull this out. Like, he could have a completely nuanced and, like, super, like, we've talked about it in ad infinitum on this podcast about all the different possibilities of, shit, I wrote a book with a couple chapters in it with Anthony about some of the things that the Night King or the others could be getting up to in the books. But on the show, not so much.
So you mentioned how in the books there's far less information even than right. in the show about the White Walkers. And no Night King at all. Do you think that there's a bigger hurdle to jump here for George to embed some of that information to make their ending more meaningful?
I mean,
is it going to take a lot more groundwork being laid in these next two books?
Well, because, like, you know, that's the thing with him being a gardener. He hasn't gardened a shit. Like, this thing has not even sprouted yet. Like, we don't like let me tell you things in the show we know about the White Walkers are not in the books. The White Walkers are capable of making symbols. The White Walkers.
That basic, huh?
The White Walkers can create, have to create themselves by stealing children or having children donated, and then the Night King touches them, they turn. Mm-hmm. The fact that there is a Night King, the fact that the Night King was created by the children of the forest by Shove, like, all those things are things we do not know in the books.
That's what I mean. It seems like there's more work to be done in the books to have that kind of nuanced, satisfying ending yes. than there was even in the show, and they didn't do it in the show.
So there's, like, on the pro side, there isn't all that, like, things that George would have to, like, you know, he's not restricted by the same rules in the show. So all those things about the Night King and the origins of the White Walkers, like, he come up with something that mm-hmm. has built in better mechanics or could tie in sure. better. And, you know, also he can just he doesn't have any of that stuff to hold him back. But also he's 5 books into a 7 book series. Mm-hmm. And we really haven't learned anything more about the White Walkers since, like, book 2. So it is. I don't know. He's got some pros. He got some cons. But yeah, it seems like fleshing this out and doing what he set out to accomplish, which is like outdoing Tolkien at his own game with his own world building, is a big task that he has to set out ahead of him.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
Patrick M., what will happen to the Night's Watch now that the Night King has been defeated? I'm assuming that the Night King has gone forever from Westeros, having been slain by Arya at the Battle of Winterfell. Do we know if all the Night's Watch men came back with Dolorous Ed, to defend Winterfell, or do you think that some remained at Castle Black, each watched by the sea or the Shadow Tower?
Oh, I would say dereliction of duty if they didn't come back with Dolorous.
Right.
Because you're not helping up at the wall anymore.
Right. I think they actually said that. That was a direct quote
in the first episode.
That, like, there's no, you know.
Yeah, no point in being at Castle Black.
Yeah. So if the White Walkers are gone.
Although, do they. Let me ask you this. They left from Eastwatch, right?
Yes.
So they wouldn't even have had time to go back to Castle Black to say, hey, we saw this wall fall. Hey, the dead are on the march. Let's go.
No, but like
there's
ravens.
They don't have any pocket ravens.
But Eastwatch is a fully equipped castle with a maester of its own. And yeah, absolutely, they could send ravens.
The castle didn't come down with the wall?
I mean, I
couldn't tell you. I didn't look at the scene again.
I think it's likely that, like, with the wall collapsing and the fact that there are, like, it'd be like, you know, we have cell phones, right? So, like, this happened in our world. You'd be like, well, they would just send a cell phone, and someone's like, well, can you prove that there was functional cell phone? Like, okay, yeah, settle down. They got ravens. The ravens will work.
It will be hilarious, though, because the ravens will take a while.
Yeah.
So they'll just roll up after the battle's already fought and won, right?
Right.
And they'll be like, man, what happened here?
Right. Now whether Night's Watch disbands, that's been a, you know, even last week we considered several ideas of what might become the Night Watch, or, you know, maybe it becomes a whole, like maybe the Night's Watch becomes like, an official standing army for the Seven Kingdoms instead of everybody having their own lords, like the Night that's now the Guardian of the Realm, like they actually mean it, like we are a force. But that's like they meant it
1,000 years ago.
They'd go from an apolitical force to an explicitly political force, you know. But that's the whole tension of Night Watch, is they have a, you know, large impressive army and lands of their own and a bunch of fortifications and castles and this giant wall, but they're forbidden to partake in the political and military affairs of the other kingdoms. Like once you go up there, it's like all you can do is guard the wall. And that's it.
So are you saying that Sansa's not going to get her wish about the North being independent?
Well, I mean, the North has nothing to do with that's the way to go. John and Sansa just build a wall at the neck.
It's a shorter wall.
And they take the wildlings that don't like kneelers in the South, and they take and they say, okay, your new job is to guard the chillness that is the North. We want to have our chill society. It's not crazy up here. Down South, they can do whatever the fuck they want. So, but yeah, no, why do you need the Night's Watch? If the Night King is dead, White Walkers are dead, and the wall has fallen.
You shouldn't.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, it's like there's a lot of theories that say that, like, now that if the Night King is truly dead, the seasons should normalize, because Martin said there's no cosmological or planet, you know, geographical reason that this stuff is happening. It's all magical. So, like, if the forces of winter have defeated, maybe you have traditional seasons and the wall will start to continue to collapse and melt into nothing. I don't know.
Planning is going to be so much easier.
Yeah. Yeah. You just know, like, hey, you got 3 months to plant and 3 months to harvest, or 3 months to grow and 3 months to harvest and 3 months to, you know, chill in your greenhouse. And the winters won't last generations anymore. All right, Michelle, could I please pick your mind on some major plot holes? Mainly, how did a wooden box keep a very violent wight locked in all the way to King's Landing, but the near dust and bones of dead Starks managed to break through stone coffins? Do Do you think it's because the whites are
the proximity of the Night King made them stronger
when they're near the Night King?
Okay. Great minds here.
Does he have like some kind of zombie Bluetooth and it weakens after 32 meters? I mean,
that's a fair question. It was just the rule of cool on that. Yeah.
And then I did. We've talked about this last season. It's like, also, wouldn't it be super funny if like this was a Michigan J Frog situation where John brings his corpse down to King's Landing and the Night King just turns him off?
Oh, okay.
Because remember, that was the whole thing, that this frog would sing and dance in front of this one guy, but every time he tried to throw it on a talk show, the frog would just sit there and be a frog. And
I
like
didn't
a
know
top
about that
hat.
Part.
But yeah, wouldn't it be funny if he opens the box and it's just a dead body?
Yeah.
And they're like,
we've seen dead bodies before,
right.
John.
Yeah, we have a
We've
bunch.
Made a whole bunch of them.
There's probably a few in the black cells right now. Moving on, Michelle wonders, as John has now fought the Night King and whites for countless times, and presumably was involved in strategizing for this battle, surely he knew that riding the Dothraki out like that was sending them into sure death.
Who are they talking about?
It says John. John's fought the Night King and the whites many times before.
Yeah, I don't think John rode the Dothraki out. I think the Dothraki rode themselves
out. They rode themselves out?
Yeah.
They were on the front lines and...
They got gung ho because they saw their flaming swords. They're like, hell yeah,
yeah,
let's do this.
We're gonna end the we got this, bros.
Yeah,
we got this, bros.
We're talking about a culture that has multiple killings at weddings. They have some bloodlust in them. They wanted to get this battle underway.
Yeah, and I mean, look, if you want to believe that the Dothraki did that, and Jorah's like, okay, YOLO, I guess I'll go along with them. Mm-hmm. I think that this is just dumb. This is a dumb strategy. Like, I mean, on the other hand,
it's a little
like,
of both, I think.
Like, John could also say, like, oh, the army of the dead, like, we fought them, and we always fought them on foot, so maybe, like, a cavalry charge, and maybe it's the horses needed, like, they needed armor that was studded with, like, dragon glass.
Yeah.
So they could just ride right through and just tear through the armies.
Hell yeah.
But also someone pointed out that the Dothraki were still using their Araks, which are just steel swords. Like, until Melisandre set them on fire, they intended to go out there. Like, was Gendry like, hey, I know you like your sword. I know you do.
But we really need to deck it out.
But you need, look, can I interest you in a dragonglass version? It's like, nah.
Can I interest you in the only weapon that is effective against your enemy?
You Westerosi with your straight-ass swords and your wearing steel armor. Look, we're going to show you how it's done in Essos.
Yeah.
And just go out there. So yeah, in that universe, I absolutely believe they get their swords lit in fire, and they just like, oh, sure, fuck it, let's do this.
You know what they needed is that contraption that Ash builds, an army of darkness, with on the front of his car.
Yes,
just these spinning blades of dragon glass.
Yes,
that would have cleaned up.
Yeah, if only we had a Hodor still alive, he could like
push
twirl like a
cart.
30. Yeah, he could be the car essentially, and he just twirls a 30-foot staff with dragon glass tips. And finally, how did we see Daenerys wield a sword to fight off loads of wights, but Sansa couldn't even use her little dagger to stab a dusty bag of bones? Mm. I think this came out of a conversation with Kim that, like, no, it wasn't. I was streaming on Twitch, twitch.tv/baldmove, last night, and there's several people that opined that they were reading... That there was some sort of production
cut scene. Yeah.
Yeah, that there's some notes that there was actually several cut scenes, and there was like some Sansa and Tyrion heroics that they cut for time. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what the fuck? Because
that sucks. Yeah.
I almost said this, but I already knew I was going to be accused from Hell to Breakfast about nitpicking. So I'm like, I'm not going to go into the esoteric art of editing. But I thought that there was a couple what felt like missing or blown edits or kind of pretty noticeable edits.
Hmm.
Like I said, they told the story of, you know, Tyrion and Sansa deciding to make the last stand. They make their way to recognizable characters we care about to make that last stand, and then the last stand never happens. And then we cut to them, you know, being victorious.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, yeah, there was a couple scenes that they cut for time. That makes no fucking sense to me. This is an hour and a half long.
It's on.
Put another 5 minutes into it.
Yeah, I don't know what they're... Yeah, I guess they don't have like fucking commercials and stuff. And if you're going an hour and a half already,
it's all budget.
Another, 12 seconds is not going to make a difference.
Yeah, and who said, like, you know what? Just take Ghost out of last episode. Boom.
Mm-hmm.
Take the 3 seconds of Ghost out, pay for a little bit more rubber skeleton time. You're good to go. Like, I don't know. I don't understand.
Yeah.
Alex, rather. With three episodes of 80-plus Mimits. Mm-hmm. That's the new way we mark time here on Game of Thrones, Mimits. With 80-plus Mimits left before we wrap up the story, I've seen quite a few think pieces and even expert YouTubers, including AltShiftX, say that there sure seems like a lot of screen time left for just the Battle of Cersei, the Clegane Bowl, and the fallout or aftermath of it all. It seems like two episodes of that length at best. Some, including AltShiftX, have proposed that we have one or more major unforeseen twists coming, and that might possibly still include the Night King coming back, or other major characters possibly taking his place, and some prophecy-spinning twist. I'm not sure how I could see that happening now, or how I'd even feel about it, but giving Game of Thrones penchant for subverting expectations, what do you guys think?
I don't think that they have a lot of screen time left, because I think all the things you listed to make them satisfying are going to, we're going to have to linger on them for a minute.
We have to linger on the Battle of Winterfell.
We do. Yeah. We still have to get through the aftermath of this battle. Mm-hmm. There's just so much shit, I think, still left to do in this series to make it satisfying as a conclusion to one of the most epic tales ever told, in my opinion. So yeah. I don't know. We just have a fundamental disagreement on that.
Yeah. I mean, you could spend a good 60 minutes just dealing with the aftermath of the series proper, because you have to give people... I mean, you can't end on a cliffhanger, which is kind of how Game mm-hmm. of Thrones typically does. Like, it ends on a cliffhanger or like a setup for, like, oh my God, it's going to be great for next season. And you can't do that this time. You have to actually satisfy and explain and give people resolutions.
And not just plot resolutions, but emotional resolutions.
Yes.
Like, all of that takes time.
Yeah.
I'm a guy who likes the Fly episode of Breaking Bad a hell of a lot.
Right.
And that was an entire hour that was nothing but delving into the guilt of a single character. Mm-hmm. So, like, they could spend an hour and a half on the resolution between Dany and Jon and who's going to be the king and queen. And if it's compelling, and they need that time to do it, I'm all for it.
Right. Yeah, it's possible that, you know, somehow the Night King comes back, because that's the horror movie way to do it, right? You think you beat the guy in the second act, and then you go in to defeat the quote-unquote real threat, and then the guy you thought you defeated pops out of a pool of lava, and he's a glowing red-hot skeleton now, and he's pissed, and he's stabbed somebody. I mean, it could, but, like, I am trying to process this by moving the fuck on. Like, this did not go the way I expected, the way many people expected, but it's the way it went down. There are still perfectly... Like, I got so many takes. I can't remember when I said this, or maybe I said it last time on a stream, but, like, there's two takes I don't get. The one take that's, like, that denies there's any problems with the episode this week, and they say they were fully satisfied and they saw no problems and everybody's just nitpicking. Like, that doesn't seem intellectually honest. But the other side of that dark coin is the people that said, after I saw The Long Night, I'm out on the series.
Yeah.
I'm like, you are not going to watch three more episodes of this show. Like,
they're long episodes, though.
They are. It's going to burn an hour and a half of your fucking Sunday night.
Uh-huh.
I know we're all in a hurry to get to bed so we can get up on Monday and start our shit lives all over again, but an extra half hour might be out of your time budget. I get it. Barry's still going on. That's really good. We're excited about Chernobyl. Like, come on. I know our TV schedules are tight here, but, like, that seems bizarre that you would... It's like walking out in the last 15 minutes of Avengers Endgame, you know? Mm. Like, Jesus Christ, you just don't want to... Hang on to see
you don't
the
want
end?
To see this through, right?
Like, even if this is a vicious car crash, don't you want to just kind of, like, you know, see how fucked up the bodies are going to look? And
I mean, there's a certain point where you're pot committed, you know, and even if you know you have a shit hand, you play it out because maybe,
right?
Because just maybe there's a chance. So you gotta stick with it.
Yeah, I mean, then if this was like three more seasons to go,
right?
But three more episodes, like, I just feel like a lot of stuff is hyperbole. And the other thing is, like, the next three episodes are great and puts a big smile on everybody's face and pays off a lot of the character moments that we actually care, you know, that everyone universally cares about. Then this might be remembered as just yet another road bump and a kind of bumpy last three seasons of the Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I think that's probably more likely than just completely shitting the bed, honestly. to come up with something that doesn't satisfy anyone, but I don't know. We'll see. Thomas O. I sat here watching this last week's episode, and it struck me that two of the biggest Lord of the Light parishioners fall as their purpose was fulfilled. As far as I could remember, there was three people that were brought back to life by what the show has you believe the Lord of Light. Beric, Melisandre, kept alive by her necklace, and John. Is it a stretch to think that John is not meant to be to end the show on the Iron Throne, but instead is being used by the Lord of Light to help usher in the next queen slash king?
So he's Lightbringer?
Yeah,
he's
the sword. I mean, I think what Thomas is saying is, like, if his purpose was to defeat the Night King, why doesn't John stop functioning? As if he's like a like the same way that Beric ran out of his Beric juice right at the time where Arya, after he protected Arya, and the same way Melisandre ran out of her Melisandre juice after the battle.
That's an interesting way to frame it. Beric got stabbed a whole bunch.
Sure.
And keeled over like a mortal human
and
would.
And the guy who brought him back to life every time died last season.
Uh-huh. Melisandre made the conscious choice to take off this necklace powering her life and died of old age. To say that they ran out of their magical juice in those moments, I think is a little disingenuous.
Yeah, especially since they could have told that story, like I said on the pod, like if Melisandre's necklace stopped glowing and she just resignedly pulls it off, like
showing that
the Lord of the Light has withdrawn his protection, and this is just a formality. But no, she pulls the thing off, throws it aside, it stops glowing several seconds after she does that.
Yeah, she made a conscious choice to die there. Yeah, I don't think that they ran out of juice.
Right.
And so I don't know why we would expect John to keel over dead. I've kind of never understood why people were hypothesizing that.
Right. All right. Jessica S. I wanted to hear your thoughts about the scenes in the crypts. I read up on the events that inspired the Reigns of Castamere on A World of Ice and Fire, not being a book reader, a few weeks ago, so the fate of House Reign is still fresh in my mind. One thing that surprised me while reading about it is the massacre of the entire house was at the hands of Tywin in his younger days when his father Tytos was still Lord of Castle Rock. House Rain offended the Lannisters by not promptly repaying their debts, so Tywin marched on them. The Rains try to backpedal to no avail and take shelter in Castamere, which is a fortress that's almost entirely underground in the many mines that the Rains had emptied of silver and gold. Tywin seals the entrances to Castamere and then floods the halls. All the men, women, and children of House Rain then drown. The parallels between this and the crypts at Winterfell give me pause. In both sieges, the weakest of the civilians are taking shelter, and when they think they're in the safest place they can be, secured and secluded, they find themselves trapped in their shelter, powerless to save themselves against an unforeseen and horrible demise. Surely Tyrion knows the story of House Rain all too well, and I'm surprised that he didn't see a catastrophe like this coming. Thoughts? I guarantee Dave and Dan have no fucking clue about this detail. There's no way there's no way they read The World of Ice and Fire that came out like, what, 2.5-3 years ago? Like, I just think that there's a couple public interviews where they've gotten like some really basic plot points about Game of Thrones. Like, I don't think they read Game of Thrones in their off season. Like, I think they're fans, and they did poured a lot of time and effort into adapting this work, but like, I don't know how much of like, they're not fans the way that we're obsessive fans. Like, I don't think they're buying The World of Ice and Fire. They probably have people read it for them, but the fact that they would pull that out or even be aware of it, I don't know. And they don't, and Tyrion doesn't know anything that they don't know. Mm-hmm. So I just think that that's, you know, the fact if, because the thing is, if Tyrion were to, like, what would he say? Would he refuse to go down to the crypts? Would he say, like, oh, no, like, it's, you know, it's safer to be up here with the army of the dead. They might flood us down there once they destroy, take over, kill every last living person in the castle. Like, also, what would he say? Like, oh, this gives me uneasy and dread because this is just like the fate of the Reigns of Castamere. Because then they'd have to sit and explain what actually happened to the Reigns of Castamere, which I guess they could do. But
yeah, I mean, if they really wanted to keep these people safe.
Yeah.
The only option, I think, is to put them on horses and keep them south of Winterfell.
Yeah.
And if shit goes bad in Winterfell, they just ride south.
That's what
and
they
abandon
did.
Winterfell.
That's why the Knights of the Vale had no horses. They took all the horses of them. They put all the best women and children and old people.
The best ones.
So
okay.
The ones in the crypt are just like...
How did they determine the best ones? I want to know.
Everyone knows. Those are the, these are
if
just
you,
the,
if we have to tell you yeah
yeah these are just the malcontents, the complainers, the whiners.
And that's why Tyrion ended up down there.
Exactly.
Yeah,
Tyrion, Sansa, both.
Oh, you don't want to be down in the crypts, huh?
Yeah,
well, you're not getting the horse then. Down the crypts.
Yeah, they actually cut that scene for time. There was a scene of the Sansa and Tyrion both complaining that, like, well, if we know we're gonna be shoved down in the crypts, we'd have taken the horses.
Yep.
They thought they were going to have a role to play. Lauren W., do you think that the crypt was broken up, well, she's referring to the white smashing her way out of the grave, to maybe reveal the silver harp? Parenthetically, she's talking about... I'll explain here in just a minute.
Okay, I have no idea what you're talking about.
But spoiler if the books... but I'm a spoiler as far as the books and all the info I can get from them. Could this prove that John is a Targaryen somehow? So there's a theory that... There's a lot of these like quasi-legends and some of the stories that old Nan tell and some of the, like the kind of like the myths and legends of Winterfell itself that says because Winterfell is famous for a bunch of different reasons. It's built by Bran the Builder, but also has this like extensive glass gardens, like a greenhouse. And that's how like Winterfell feeds its people throughout the long winters because they can still grow like on a limited scale, fresh fruits and vegetables and things. It's not just their larder. They can get like vitamin C essentially. But also, the castle is kept warm by geothermal heat vents. It's like cleverly constructed so this heat from the earth rises. And one of the legends, because they don't know fucking plate tectonics in Westeros, or at least no one but the maesters does, is that there's a dragon, like an ancient dragon that's sleeping beneath Winterfell. So some people have taken that and like this whole R plus L equals J stuff and the fact that, you know, like how would John prove that he is the legitimate, you know, son of such and such. And one of the ideas to square the idea that there is a dragon buried underneath Winterfell. And this other plot point is that there is some kind of token of Rhaegar's affection buried with Lyanna, perhaps his famous silver harp. Perhaps Rhaegar himself is interred with her. Something that would prove that, like, oh, this was actually an up-and-up-in relationship and not a kidnapping-slash-rape situation. So if the show had laid tracks to that, and, like, they... And I can't remember if they conspicuously showed Lyanna's, like Lyanna's tomb is the one's broken open, and someone was, like, cleaning up this in the next episode, and they found this exquisite silver harp. I could see it, but... I guess more than ever, I don't see how Danny and John just immediately start up their beef about the succession after this thing that they've gone through. Like, how the fuck do you go immediately back to squabbling about who rules after you went through the situation where you both saved each other and like either one of you could get died at either point, that John's sister slash cousin is the one that ended this all? Like, I mean, how can Danny? Yeah,
it does seem a little petty.
Wouldn't that bring Danny down a notch? The fact that your fucking largest army and the dragons didn't do shit. We needed a little girl with magic ninja training.
Maybe she should be queen.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah, it's... I feel you. It's not like they should, you know, turn around with piles of bodies behind them and say, so, about that queen-king business. But... it is a central thing that I think needs to be resolved. Yeah. I don't know if they can immediately have that conversation, but soon they'll have to. And I think Sansa might actually be the one to push on that because, you know, she basically was told the North has no chance of seceding essentially from My Seven Kingdoms. In no words, she was told that. So she, I'm sure, wants a resolution to that. She'll probably push.
Yeah. I mean, so I actually think Sansa might be even worse because from her perspective, if it wasn't for the North and Winterfell in particular, like the entire world would end and
for
like
sure.
the Stark line, you know, like it's like, I can't even imagine how offensive it would be to have to kneel to a Southern king, like queen, as even though Dany had, you know, her part that she played in this war, like it would be downright offensive to be like, what the fuck? We did the vast majority of the dying. Our ancestral home was the ground zero for this defeat. Our like, you know, our dead ancestors were fucking turned into abominations during this war. Like we've suffered a lot and we gave a lot and we were instrumental. There's no freaking way that we're going to go back to being just a vassal. So because that's kind of her thing, you know, like what is like, how can I make sure that this doesn't happen again? How can I make sure the North is protected? And it's going to be, you know, kind of like we talked about the last few weeks. It's going to be John and Danny trying to figure out how to smooth this over in a way that makes everybody else happy. Because I think they're going to be fine.
Yeah, I think John is going to say, look, I don't even want this.
Yeah.
And now if you and Sansa want to fight over this, like I will try and be some kind of arbiter in the whole thing. But I don't want to be the king.
Sure.
He's never wanted to be the king.
But I mean, the other thing is like it's also a kind of a done story because if he was Well, this goes back to all the other bullshit we always talk about. But if John was the king of the North, and I think he was, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody elected him by crying, "King of the North."
That's how kings happen. They get elected.
That's how we should. They get chanted into effect in the great halls of North. Then he's entirely in his power to abdicate to some other power.
Yeah. And I would argue he's already done so.
And the only ones that could stop that are the great lords that would be like, well, fuck that. We're going to take over and we're going and I'm going to put my crown, my hand in for the king of the North. And they're all dead, apparently.
Yeah.
So, like, I just don't see, like, Sansa can say what she wants, but she's the Lady of Winterfell. He's the king of the North. And he's just the king that knelt again. Jordan T. So how about the Army of the Living now? We know that they got to be dwindled down to almost nothing. Doesn't sound so good for the inevitable battle with Cersei. Well, I think there may be a backup army that most have forgotten about. We know Ilaria is still locked up in the cells of King's Landing, watching her daughter's body wither away. How does that help things? Well, I think we're going to see Yara take what few men she has left and go on a covert Squid Team 6 type mission to infiltrate the Red Keep and rescue Ilaria. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe they were on their way to pick up the Dornish army when Euron burned the fleet, which leads me to believe that there's still an entire army down there trying to go. We've talked about the Dornish army. This is the first time someone's put forth a plausible theory for how they could be put into action. We've seen Yara pull off similar stunts in her attempts to rescue Theon from Winterfell, and I think it would be a cool callback to Bronn's famous, "Give me 10 good men and I'll impregnate the bitch" line, because he might even help on the mission. I find it hard to believe that one of the Seven Kingdoms would just be ignored in this final season. Dorne has to have a role to play in the endgame here, right?
I mean, that could be cool, yeah.
Could be cool, but, like, I really wouldn't get your hopes up on it.
I don't even know if Yara is aware that Ilaria is alive.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so I don't think that's the interesting question. The interesting question is, if Yara showed up to rescue her, would you be like, how the fuck did she know about this? Like, I think that, like, with spies and intelligence and maybe that you could just assume that she'd found out somehow.
Okay. I almost think they have to show that. Otherwise, it just seems like she lied to Theon about where she was going.
Yeah. Well, or maybe she, like, felt guilty about sitting there. Or maybe she hears that Theon went out like a hero and now it's like galvanized to like do her part. You know?
That's what I mean. They have to show something. They have to let us know why she chooses to do what she didn't say she was going to do the last time we saw her.
So here's the thing. Yara's not a coward. And her stated goal was to go back. Like, I don't have enough to make to provide any kind of real help at Winterfell. And I don't have any ships to get him there in the first place. What I'm going to do is go back to Iron Islands and take it so there's a refuge, like a fallback spot for the living and the dragons, where they'll be safe from the Night's King for a time that we can, you know, once the Night King's defeated, then the only reason Yara would have to stay, hang back and not do anything, especially when we're talking about the Squid Team 6, like, you know, just give me 10, 20 good men and you can do this thing, would be cold feet, cowardice, wanting to test the political winds. Like, I think this theory checks out. It's just that, like, look, I would like to encourage everyone that's disappointed in this last episode to declare fan bankruptcy. Just, you could do it like Michael Scott. Just, I declare fan bankruptcy. And then just, like, you got a clean slate. And see if you could enjoy these next three episodes on their own terms without any expectations. Because what I see a lot of people doing is doubling down. They owe $10,000 to the fan theory casino, and they
put it all in black.
They put their fan theory mortgage and they're betting it on black. I'm like, no. Yeah. Declare fan bankruptcy and you might be pleasantly surprised. Don't mortgage the fan theory house, okay?
Like,
don't let yourself get radicalized by what the Double D's are doing to your favorite franchise. Unless you're just out. Unless these people that say they're out are actually out, and I wish you guys well. I mean, that's not an option for me. I've got a contractual obligation to do these shows at this point. So what would happen if we just stopped? If we did that?
I mean, I don't think there's anything anybody could do about it.
There was a podcast that rage quit like 3 years ago. Like, said that, like, I forget what point
after
it was.
What?
It was in season...
Was it the way they handled Dorne?
I think it was season five. And they just said, you know what? And it was one of the bigger ones. It was like one of the top probably 10, 12 podcasts. And they said, you know, we're not going to do this anymore.
Huh.
That'd be bonkers. But yeah, I'm not, again, just this three more episodes. Let's see how it goes. That's the podcast. Thanks for everyone for the feedback. Again, I encourage everyone to declare some fan bankruptcy, work out a payment plan with your fan theory creditors, and move on with your life and see if they can't get you excited this next episode. Because, you know, after this one, it's the penultimate and then the finale. Mm-hmm. So let's just clean slate this thing. Maybe we'll be pleasantly surprised, and they'll take all these threads that we've seen that are all over the place that could be picked up, and with the right monologue, the right set of flashbacks, the right Bran doing his wide-eyed thing, the right scene of Sam doing something at the Citadel, they could actually make it better. But let's not expect that. Let's just, you know, my now modest hope is that we have some nice resolution between John and Danny. Something nice for Brienne, Jaime and Tyrion having some kind of thematically appropriate either end or end point for their character to be signed off on the series, and that Cersei and her crew. Oh yeah, Hound of the Clegane Bowl's got to happen. Yeah. My button's broke, but
Sansa's got
hype, air horns, all that kind of stuff.
Sansa's
got to get something good, and Cersei's got to be served out finally. Mm-hmm. That's it. I don't even need it to, like, Valonqar, get that word out of your fucking mouths. get that word out of your mouths. I can't wait to see, like, someone twist the word Valonqar into meaning, like, anything.
Yeah, just a dire wolf.
Yeah, right. Well, uh-huh. It's, you know, Nymeria, how would you prove that Nymeria was younger than any other direwolf pup?
They found
it sucking on the dead mother's teeth. Like, maybe Ghost is the runt. You can say that he was, maybe, but...
Cut it open, count the rings.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. After Nymeria dies, they cut her open, they count her direwolf rings, they find out that she was the youngest sister of the pups, and that she's the Valonqar, and a gender-bending, cross-species fulfillment of fucking Game of Thrones prophecy. And that's what's going to happen. You heard it here first. Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. We'll be back Sunday night for the Instant Take and Instant Talk podcast if you are a club member. And we'll see what happens. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.